I'm Dan Rodericks, and this is Midday. For the first time since the funeral of Freddie Gray, the riots that followed, and the announcement of charges against six Baltimore police officers in Gray's death, Mayor Stephanie Rawlings-Blake joins us on the show. While questions have been raised about the mayor's handling of the chaos and destruction of April 27th, greater questions remain about the days and months ahead. What, if anything, can the city do to finally address some of the long-standing problems laid bare by the unrest? Will the mayor form an alliance with Governor Larry Hogan to address poverty, high unemployment, and neighborhood blight? If the relationship with police and thousands of Baltimoreans is broken, how to fix it? Open phones. My questions and yours for the mayor of Baltimore after the news from NPR. And welcome to Midday, everyone. Dan Rodericks here. Thanks again for joining us on WYPR. We're here until 2 o'clock every weekday, WYPR, WYPF, Frederick and Hagerstown, WYPO on the eastern shore of Maryland, and streaming live online through WYPR.org. Open phone lines in this hour for the mayor of Baltimore, Stephanie Rawlings-Blake, visiting us in the studio. Nice to have you on the show again, Mayor. How are you?
I'm good. How
people,
about you?
People ask you that a lot these days. How are you? How are you doing? How is the city doing? What do you say to people?
I say our city is resilient. Our city is not going to be deterred by the actions of a few. There's so many people who want to make sure not just that the rest of Baltimore understands, but the rest of the world understands that what you saw, what the cameras were eager to catch was the worst of us. But it's not the entire story of Baltimore, the true story of Baltimore, all those people who did so many heroic things. I mean, not to mention the way that the first responders dealt with the demonstrations. I mean, they were masterful. The police, that our local police officers, the officers that we had from other jurisdictions, the firefighters, the EMS, everyone, in the face of great danger, really handled themselves with distinction. When you took a look at the community members that stood between the agitators that wished to destroy our city and first responders, that's Baltimore. When you saw people just saying, look, we see what happened, but it's not going to be the end of Baltimore's story, that picked up brooms, started cleaning, making sure that the businesses were open and that the community could start to heal, that is Baltimore. We're resilient, and that's what I believe I am as well.
Are we taking time to understand what the April 27th uprising was about, its connection to the Freddie Gray case? Are you going to officially study it, and do you have any sense of what that was about?
I think there's no one thing that it was about. There were a lot of what I believe were very powerful, peaceful demonstrations, and there were a few people that used an opportunity when there was a lot of frustration and tension and demonstrations, they exploited that situation for their own personal gain and a misguided attempt to make a statement. I don't know, when you talk to students, I mean, I've been spending time talking to young people. You talk to students as young as fourth grade, and they look at you and they say, that looting, that store they destroyed down the street from my house, that had nothing to do with Freddie Gray. If those fourth graders know it, I think, adults need to listen and acknowledge that, the protesters had a purpose. The looters had a self-interest.
Those who were throwing stones and pieces of brick at police at Mondawmin and firefighters on April 27th on that afternoon, when did we know that that was going to happen? Would you mind talking a little bit about the notice we received for this? Because it all happened so quickly. And the question within the question is, were they taking advantage of something there because of what they saw on Saturday? That because of the disturbances downtown on Saturday, they felt on Monday they could do more. They could further exploit the situation. and that that police would stand down and, you know, they would have room to launch an attack.
So
what was going on?
I just wanted to back up to this room to attack and just be very clear. I would never, I have never, I did at no time give a stand down order to the police. I've worked too hard for the past 20 years in public service to build up my city. I would never give the order or give the impression to anyone that works for me that that was my intent to give people space to destroy. In an attempt to describe the fact that people exploited and took advantage of, while some people were exerting their rights, their First Amendment rights, and in that space where people were demonstrating, even the protests that were less than peaceful, most of them didn't get destructive, but some people took advantage of that space and used it to destroy our city. It was in my attempt to describe it, people think that I endorsed it. Absolutely not. I didn't endorse it, didn't tolerate it. And we've been, very aggressive with making sure that that type of activity was very limited to a few hours on Saturday and a few hours on Monday.
I guess I was trying to understand the connection, if any, between what happened Saturday and what happened on Monday. That the idea got in the heads of some that let's attack
right.
the police.
Got it. So you talked about the notice. The reason why there were so many officers that had been deployed and pre-positioned around Mondawmin on Monday is because the police had been monitoring at many levels, had been monitoring social media, and it was had been made aware of an attempt to have some sort of uprising, some type of demonstration at Mondawmin Mall. And having seen what we saw on Saturday, we wanted to make sure that those officers were pre-positioned. And let me just also say that throughout the previous week, every day, there were more and more resources brought into the city from other jurisdictions as well as outside of the state to make sure that we had the support that we needed to have peace in our city. So we brought in officers that had arrest powers that could actually be that support and enforcement support on the ground for our officers, and that is why we were able to pre-position. A lot of things, so we did have notice, and that's why those officers were there. Why they decided to use it as an opportunity to try to hurt the people who put their lives on the line every day to protect them, I couldn't tell you. It certainly hasn't. It doesn't lead to a more productive relationship between young people and our police. I can tell you that.
What is your response to those who say you should have called Governor Hogan sooner and got the National Guard in place on Monday?
I would say that, the facts are clear. I mean, we had the officers and the resources we needed on Saturday to turn what was a peaceful protest. When it turned ugly, we were able to contain it. Sunday was peaceful. Sunday night, the Gray family said that if you respect our family and the memory of Freddie Gray, that we want Monday, the day that we are laying him to rest, to be peaceful. We had word that there was going to be activity at Mondawmin that was similar to what we saw on Saturday, which, again, we were able to contain and get under control. So we put those resources in place to be able to respond to it. On Monday, when things changed, we did everything that we needed to do as soon as it was possible to get those additional resources in place. I don't know of many people who think the proper response to high school kids when we know that there's going to be some type of demonstration. I don't know of many people that would say the proper response is the National Guard, with the information that we had.
You're looking at the lesson of Ferguson about the presence or the presentation the police make?
The presentation.
Of the National Guard?
Their,
that could further incite people, is that it?
further incite people, as well as, you know, we don't, people can second guess, I should have done it this time, that time, whatever. We've seen what happened when jurisdictions jump the gun and they over-militarize in response to civil unrest. And it's gone from a one-day event into a week-long event of rioting. Look at what we had. We had Saturday. When it got out of control, we were able to get it under control. We had Monday. When it got out of control, we called the National Guard, and it was limited. And the overwhelming majority of the demonstrations were peaceful. We were able to restore order to the city, and we are, you know, we are repairing our city. So, you know, you can say you should have done it this, you should have done it that. We've seen what happens when you pull that trigger on bringing in that militarized response too early. And like I said, I don't know of many people who would think that the appropriate response to demonstration by high school students is to pre-position the National Guard. I just, you know, it just didn't make sense with the information that we had. I will say that when it was clear that we needed additional resources, without hesitation, I made that call. And I think that the evidence of what happened subsequent shows it was the right thing to do.
On the other hand, here's a question from Michael, one of our listeners, because we invited questions for the mayor in advance of the show today. We'll take calls while she's with us here in Studio A. Michael's question is, why did the police make a show of force before any indication of unrest? And do you think that exacerbated or even instigated the violence at Mondawmin?
The officers didn't instigate anything. They were pre-positioned to make sure that there was order, and they were heroic and masterful in their response. And they were, because of their skill and their professionalism, what we've seen in other jurisdictions didn't happen here in Baltimore. It was a few hours on Monday evening, and we were able to, with the support that we got from other resources, restore order in our city.
Well, you've heard this before, that some people say if the police weren't there with riot gear and shields, that there wouldn't have been rocks and bricks thrown at them. It wouldn't have that further incited those young men.
I think that was from people who weren't out there.
All right. Well, 410-662-8780 is our phone number here on Midday. If you have a question for Mayor Stephanie Rawlings-Blake of Baltimore during this hour of the show, several questions already that have been emailed to us, and we welcome more at midday@wypr.org. So, Mayor, please tell us about the announcements. This is Wednesday. You've come from the Board of Estimates meeting, and then you made an announcement regarding One Baltimore. And I guess first I should ask you to explain to our listeners what exactly One Baltimore is, mm-hmm. and then the announcement you made with regard to it.
So thanks for, turning us into the forward-looking for healing and rebuilding Baltimore. One Baltimore, the announcement we made last week, was our initiative to bring together all of the segments, all the parts of our community that want to make Baltimore better, that have that want to do the work, that want to donate, that want to help, bring us together to have a collaborative and a intentional response, and not a knee-jerk, okay, we're going to, you know, give this group $5,000, give that group $40,000, and you know, wipe your hands of it. If we are going to seriously confront these systemic issues and take advantage of all of the attention and the desire of people who want Baltimore to see better, we have to be coordinated and we have to collaborate. We can't have, 10 different organizations doing 20 different things. We have to figure out first, you know, how do we engage the community in meaningful ways to empower them, to help to create their own future, to talk about the issues that they want us to confront. How can we collaborate using all the resources we have here and the tremendous resources, whether it's the educational institutions, the philanthropic, the foundations, all of those. How can we get together and say, okay, we hear you, and now this is the plan for how to get you where you want to be, to deal with those issues? And that's our One Baltimore.
Does One Baltimore address, when we say systemic issues, poverty, high unemployment, blighted neighborhoods? What about police brutality, excessive force by police? Is it meant to address that as well?
No, that's the DOJ investigation.
Okay, so you're going to leave that in the hands of the Department of Justice. One Baltimore is about more social neighborhood issues, community issues.
Yes.
And the announcement you made today with regard to that.
Yes, that Michael Crier, who I'm sure you've probably had on this show before.
We have, but not in a few years. We had him here when in his capacity as, chairman of the Democratic Party in Maryland some years ago.
So he will be directing that effort, and I'm extremely grateful that someone who has been a lifelong Baltimorean, who has the capacity and the relationships to bring those groups together, and the spirit of service, and to really shepherd this effort. And I'm really grateful that he's on board.
Why did you select Michael Crier? I mentioned his experience with the Democratic Party.
He's got a lot of experience with, not just the Democratic Party. You know, he's a well-regarded businessman who has the ear of local businesses, local elected officials, and has a spirit for service. He wants these communities to do better, and he wants to engage those who want Baltimore to be better, to be involved in this long-term conversation. This isn't about making sure that kids have that we say, okay, we've employed 2,000 more kids this summer. Congratulations, pat yourself on the back and move on. No, we have an opportunity here to talk about the way that we do business. Not just the city of Baltimore does business, but our local institutions and job creators. How are we doing everything we can to create that pipeline for opportunities for Baltimore City residents? And if we aren't, what are those barriers to employment, and how can we work together as a community to remove those so we can make those pathways for more people in our communities to provide for themselves and for their families? What are those other things, the educational barriers? What are those things that we can identify as the root causes? And then how can we rip those roots out and create those pathways for our communities?
One Baltimore also asked for donations.
Absolutely.
So tell us a little bit about that before we take our break. If people were to make donations to this through this website that's been established, what would that money be used for?
First, I want to make sure that everyone understands that the money that comes in will be accounted for. And when that money goes out, whether it's for a youth program or for business support, there'll be accountability measures. So if there's a youth program that gets it or an employment program, we want to know how those funds were used. How did it help support your effort? So it's going for all of those things that I talked about. If you donate, it'll go to support those businesses. There's a business recovery fund as a part of our overarching efforts. And I want to thank Don Fry and the Greater Baltimore Committee, who in their annual meeting raised over $200,000 in one night to support the businesses who have been impacted by the riots and the looting. So, it'll go to all of those things, whether it's for capital support for rec centers or schools, all of the needs that we address, the short-term needs, as well as paving the way for us to address some of these systemic issues.
We have to take a break here on Midday. We'll come back for more questions for Mayor Stephanie Rawlings-Blake. You're welcome to join us at 410-662-8780. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Midday. Dan Roderick's here with Mayor Stephanie Rawlings-Blake. It was only last week you asked the Department of Justice to come in and investigate the Baltimore City Police Department. Do you wish you had done that sooner? Do you think, looking back, that maybe you should have acted sooner on that?
This is the deal. At any point, if the Department of Justice believed that we needed a pattern of practice review, they would have imposed it, right? So I could have... No matter what I ask for or when, they don't wait for jurisdictions. When they think that it's necessary, they act. Last year, when I asked them to work with us on a collaborative review, they did an assessment. If they thought that we needed a pattern and practice civil rights review, they would have done it. Had nothing to do with, if I would have asked sooner. They wouldn't have accepted the collaborative reform, the collaborative review, if they thought we needed a pattern of practice. We put that the collaborative review in place. That's been very successful in many cities around the country, and I'd hope that it would help further the work that we had already been doing in reforming the police department and working to bridge that gap between the community and the police. When I thought that we needed stronger tools, I asked for them, and I'm grateful that the Department of Justice agreed. Should I have asked sooner? They don't wait for jurisdictions, but they think a pattern and practice review is investigation is necessary. It has nothing to do with when a mayor asks.
So the death of Freddie Gray changed that?
I think a lot of things changed that. The collaborative review had started, and many people in that process, said that they wanted to make sure that the changes that we were able to make in the police department were enforceable and sustainable. There were a lot of factors to consider.
If the relationship between the Baltimore police and thousands of Baltimoreans is broken, how do we fix that?
I think we fix it first by acknowledging that it's going to take work. We didn't get here overnight. It's not going to change overnight. It will change when people who are committed to better are willing to do the work to get us there. And that's all around. It's not just a police issue. It's not just a government issue. It's not just a community issue. It is us making this commitment that we're going to work on this relationship together. Now, I often say, and sometimes people admonish me for saying, I'm like, we're married. We're in this. There's no way that the community can be as safe as it would like to be without the police. And there's no way the police can be as effective as they would like to be in making our community safer without the help of the residents. We're in this marriage. There's no, we can't get divorced. Separation is not possible. We're in it. And we have to do that work, that repair work.
We have a long way to go there.
Oh, absolutely.
And you and the Fraternal Order of Police, the leadership of the Fraternal Order of Police, the FOP, says that, they want the Department of Justice to investigate you as well. They've also said a couple of times that they put out a blueprint. They called it a blueprint that was published, I think, in 2011 or 2012. That address some of these concerns about excessive force and discipline of police and wonder whether it was taken seriously. Some in the leadership think it was dismissed.
Well, I think if you take a look at their blueprint and you take a look at some of the work that we've done in the reforms that we've implemented in the police department, you can see very clearly that some of their things have been not just considered, but have been a part of the plan moving forward. The fact that we didn't take their blueprint and put a new cover on it and implement every part of it as the reforms for Baltimore City isn't to suggest that we didn't take it seriously. But I would challenge them this. The same way that we considered their blueprint and incorporated some of the reforms, I would ask them to be bold and consider some of the reforms that we've put on the table. The community has said very clearly that some of the barriers of trust are rooted in what they believe are unfair elements of the Law Enforcement Officer's Bill of Rights. And I've had this conversation with the FOP about the fact that the status quo is not going to hold. There are going to be changes. When I was down there in Annapolis fighting in a very lonely fight for reforms to the Law Enforcement Officers Bill of Rights, I told them then, I said it might not be this session, it might not be next session, but change is coming. And you have a unique opportunity to lead, not just in Baltimore and the state of Maryland, but around the country. You have the ability to lead and say, listen, we know that they are that these elements make it impossible for us to have the relationship that we want with the community. And we're willing to sit down and have this conversation and make meaningful change. The same way that they want us to look at the blueprint, I would ask them to take a look themselves and not just, point the finger, but to take up the work of hearing the community and being willing to accept that there has to be change.
410-662-8780 is our phone number for Midday. We'll go to the phone lines to take some questions for Mayor Stephanie Rawlings-Blake of Baltimore. Nigel, back on the question of April 27th, a question for the mayor. Nigel, go right ahead, please.
Good afternoon, and thank you for taking my call. I want to say good afternoon to the mayor.
Good afternoon.
I have a question for you that was related to the handling of the so-called riot issue that occurred between the Mondawmin Mall and Douglas School. Were there any coordination between that school leadership, police department, and the transit system as to how to properly and safely move the kids out of the school without them having to come into the Mondawmin Mall area? And why was it necessary for them to be faced with riot gear, even though it was a rumor? Why should they come out and the first thing that they saw was riot gear?
So there was coordination for a public safety response. The school police worked with the Baltimore City Police on a response. And you have to understand that it's not the mall that was the issue. It's the metro and the bus stops. Mondawmin Mall is a major transportation hub. So the convergence on that mall slash transit station was inevitable in order for, you know, the young people from not just Douglas, but I think it's about 8 or 9 other schools use that as their hub to get home.
So was there coordination? The question is, was there coordination between Douglas and the police department that afternoon?
There was a lot of coordination, but all the coordination in the world, you can see when things turn violent and ugly. You know, you have to make decisions on the ground in response to those, and that's what you saw happening.
Mario in Baltimore, you're up next. You're on with Mayor Stephanie Rawlings Blake. Go right ahead.
Yeah, thank you very much for taking my call, and I want to commend Mayor Blake, you know, for her duty. You know, she's been very diligent, and I like the way she's doing the job here. I have just 3 points here. First of all, is the police relationship with the people. I think, you know, from my experience being around here in Baltimore, the Baltimore City Police has been the aggressor most of the time. You know, from my experience, and they're not very friendly with the people. And they take this very military and on, you know, very, like, they're always on the edge, very low tolerance. And the way they approach the people is very unlike the police that I should believe, you know, that anybody would believe they are. So they have to do a whole lot of work with their attitude with the people, be respectful to the people, and don't treat anybody like as if everybody you walk up to is a potential criminal before even addressing the issue. So,
Mario, did you have a question?
Yeah, you know, pertaining to that, you know, my question is, you know, how will the mayor, you know, try to change this, you know, this cycle of police behavior, you know, in the city?
Very
good. What is he willing to do to change that?
Right. Thank you, Mario.
So far before Ferguson and the incidents that we had with Freddie Gray, I acknowledged very clearly, you know, not trying to sweep it under the rug, that we had problems with the relationship between the community and the police. When it was time for me to hire a new commissioner, before I even interviewed any of the candidates, I talked to community members from all over the city, about 30 different people, and I said, if you were in my seat, if you were making the decision for the next police commissioner, tell me what you would be looking for. What's the type of relationship that you want to have with the police department? And east, west, north, south, you know, didn't matter age, race, religion. Everyone said the same thing, that they want a commissioner and a department that will work in partnership. I heard from many communities that say every time we see the police, they look at us as if we're perpetrators and not partners. And they were tired, and they wanted better, and they wanted a department that really believed and demonstrated a belief in community policing, that partnership that has to exist if you're going to have sustainable change when it comes to public safety. So I looked for a police commissioner who has a track record of being a reformer, one that believed in the power of working with the community, and that's what I got in Commissioner Batts. From the very beginning, with the Wasserman report, he had outside eyes take a look at the Baltimore City Police Department, identify significant areas of weakness, lay a pathway forward for how we can improve the police department. When we went around to the community to the the police districts and did our public safety forums before Ferguson, before all of these different things that are in the press now, and had this conversation with the community, asking the very simple question, how can we work better together? It was very clear. It didn't matter which police district we were in, all nine districts, and with the youth public safety town hall that I had, that the issue of police brutality was at the top of the list. It was very clear that we needed to do more. The police commissioner listened. He not only heard, he listened, and then implemented preventing harm, new increased protocols for how we could work to eliminate police brutality, excessive force in our community. So, you know, we have the foundation for this work already, and I know that with the continued work with the collaborative reform as well as the investigation, it will have the teeth that we need to see sustainable change. This isn't, you know, I just want to be clear. This is not an issue that is new on my radar screen. It's been something that has been front and center for me for years, and something that I've worked on in bridging the gap. And I hope that with the unrest that we've seen, that more people in the community understand that they have to be a part of the conversation if we're going to, and the part of the work if we're going to really repair repair that relationship and get to a more productive place.
A question from Brooks. How do you measure morale in the police department now, given all that's happened, and recruitment of new officers? And lastly, what sort of psychological screening is done for applicants to the BCPD and rescreening once officers are on the police force? First of all, morale. So morale, recruitment, and then psychological screening.
Morale has been impacted. The officers, you know, understandably, many are deflated. And, you know, for people who put their lives on the line every time they, you know, they punch the card to show up for work, they're putting their lives on the line to protect the people of Baltimore. The past few weeks have been rough. The hours have been exhausting, and there is a physical and a morale response to that. What I can say is what I've heard from community members is that they're doing everything that they can to shore up our officers, to say thank you to our officers. You know, the vast majority of the officers, the men and women of the police department, of the fire department, you know, they serve our city with distinction. They are public servants out of an amazing calling of selfless service. And more people are using this as an opportunity to say thank you and look for ways to support our first responders. And I would consider, I would ask more people from our community to consider finding ways to show support for the men and women who are our first responders around the city.
Do you have a sense of how recruitment's going for new officers?
I do not have a current assessment of recruitment.
Can you comment about psychological screening of applicants?
I don't know the exact screening, but I know that there is an extensive psychological screening when you enter the force.
And what about follow-up rescreening once officers are on the force for a while?
I'm not sure, and I can certainly get that information.
But is that something you think should be looked at?
We might have it already. I just don't know
about
the rescreening.
One last question. This has come up before when you've been on our air. Someone always asks this. Do you think we should require police officers to live in Baltimore City?
I can say that I'm doing a lot of work to encourage officers to live in the city. Part of my Vacants to Value initiative it first started with incentives for police officers, firefighters, and teachers to buy homes in the city, and they would get a significant monetary benefit or incentive. And we expanded that to all city employees. So I'm certainly doing things to make it more attractive for officers to live in the city. And I can say, whether it's the police department or the fire department, we have leaders in both departments who are actively recruiting locally. Chief Ford in the fire department has classes at two or three different high schools that will prepare students to go from high school into these positions to have the training that they need to matriculate. And to, he says that he considers these our high schools his farm teams, mm-hmm. and he wants them to be prepared to enter the department so he can ensure that more Baltimore City residents are finding their way to a career in the fire department. And the police commissioner is doing the same thing with engaging young people through Explorer camps, through partnerships with Outward Bound, to create those relationships and make sure that young people understand that this is a potential career option for them in the future.
The mayor is with us for the remainder of the hour. If you have a question, please give us a call. 410-662-8780. This is Midday. Right back to the phone lines. Questions for Mayor Stephanie Rawlings-Blake, Paul in Harbor East. Welcome to Midday. Go right ahead.
Thanks, Dan. And, Mayor, I do not envy your job. You've got quite a bit on your plate. I think I'd like to make a comment before I even ask my question. The issue of the Fraternal Order of Police has come up. And one of the things that I think really upset me, above and beyond the accusations, is that after the state attorney filed her charges against the six officers, the Fraternal Order of Police came out and said that these six officers were completely innocent of all the charges. And number one, for them to make that assessment before a trial is a bit of a conflict of interest, but I think it's also extraordinarily self-serving of them to make that kind of charge, considering that we're not just talking about what has just happened over the death of Freddie Gray, but what's been going on for decades. Anyway, so I got that off my chest.
Okay, there. Paul, to your question, please.
Yes, there's a huge amount of money going into the heroin trade. If this 65,000 heroin addict figure is correct, and unfortunately I have no idea how much heroin costs, but assuming it costs $20 a day, that's $1.3 million a day going out of the legitimate economy into the drug traffic, which is about $400 million a year. That's a huge, enormous sum of money.
Your question, Paul.
What kind of program is being implemented to try to stop the diversion of that kind of money out of legitimate enterprise?
So the 65,000 number is way skewed. That being said, you know, whether it's, you know, 10,000 or 65,000, and I don't think any of those numbers are numbers to brag about when you talk about the number of people whose lives are impacted by heroin. You know, I spent almost 10 years as a public defender, and I saw the impact of heroin on communities, the impact on families, on individuals, people, being robbed of their ability to reach their potential in life because of the degradation of this addiction, this horrible addiction. And we have a health commissioner who's committed to reducing heroin or overdose related deaths in the city, as well as supporting the addiction services, so we can get more people into recovery. We have the Recovery Corps program that's using that is engaging people who have had success in recovery and using them as a pathway for more people to find their way to recovery. I said, for somebody like me who's never touched drugs in her life, I can't. The pathway that I would suggest doesn't really resonate with people who are in the throes of addiction. But if I'm speaking as someone who has been there and has made my way out, that's a true light. That's a true beacon that people can use as peers. And we know that peer-to-peer model works, whether it's on whether it's with students or whether it's with business development or whether it's with recovery. And we're using that model to help as well.
It's a follow-up question from Kevin by email. The main reason there is an overabundance of police in the black and minority community is because of the war on drugs. What is the mayor prepared to do to scale down these failed policies? What's her stance on legalizing cannabis in Maryland? Would she be open to making cannabis possession tickets a non-priority, or tickets for them a non-priority for cops in the city? Citations, he means.
So I think, people are kind of stuck in the rhetoric, the policing rhetoric of the past. I've never been a proponent of the war on drugs, or I've never been a proponent of our focus being on these small marijuana arrests. What you have seen under my administration, in spite of this recent uptick in violence, is that we've been able to continue to have reductions in violence. At the same time, we've been reducing the number of arrests in our city. And we've done that because we are focusing on that small group of people who are creating the vast amount of violence in our city. So that this notion that, you know, that we have zero tolerance or this war on drug mentality is just not reflected in any of the policies that we've had in place under my administration.
We've had surges in violent crime before in the city. We've had another one here since the riots of April 27th, a particularly bad one. And homicides are up, I think, 30% over last year at this time. Have you asked Police Commissioner if there's any connection between it and what's happened here in the last 2 weeks?
It's undeniable that there's a connection. The issue is making sure that we are responsive, and we are.
What do you think the connection is?
I mean, there's a hundred different connections. There's, you know, the resources that we put in place to address, you know, the unrest. You know, there are a lot of connections, I would say. I mean, it's hard to articulate every single one of them, but, you know, I don't think there is a mistake.
Okay. Suggesting maybe there's less policing as a result of...
No.
Because our police force was strained during that time, only until last week when the curfew was lifted.
I think there was definitely strain on the police force, and I think that we have to shift our resources in a way that responds. You know, crime isn't static, and nor can we be in our deployments, and that's why I worked so hard to get the new police contract in place so we could be more responsive to things like this. And, you know, we have been the notion that something like the last few weeks could happen without there being an impact. There are impacts across the board. Businesses have been impacted. Communities have been impacted, and our public safety, you know, the men and women of the department, as well as our efforts have been impacted. But just like the recovery of our businesses, we will recover when it comes to our public safety fight as well.
Munir Bahar, leader of the Anti-Violence 300-Man March, is calling us to say something to the mayor. Welcome to the show, Munir.
Yeah, how you doing, Dan? And okay. How you doing, Madam Mayor?
Great, Munir.
You know, it's really not directed to the mayor, but I think it's important for really the audience and everyone to really understand, you know, the community's responsibility. As you mentioned, in the uptick in violence, it's not because, and I can say honestly, because I know everybody that's working, it's not because folks aren't working enough in terms of the police, in terms of the mayor's administration. You know, that there's an equal responsibility for the community. You know, if every caller who's called in your show, if not only they call to ask for the mayor to do something, but if they also initiated their involvement in what's going on in Baltimore City, we would see a drastic reduction in violence and crime in the city. I can tell you, as one who was on the ground floor, what is missing is not actions, you know, from just our government officials. And I'm not saying everyone, you know, has a clean slate, but the primary missing piece in our communities, what is contributing to all of these problems that we talk about, is the lack of community members engaged and being involved on a consistent basis.
Okay. You want to comment that? Thank you for that, Munir. That's been Munir's theme here all along.
Yeah, I have to applaud Munir, because a lot of people are willing to point fingers, to play the blame game, to comment, but they're not willing to put in the work. And Munir is someone, you know,
He's committed.
He is out on the front line. He is committed in a way that encourages others to get out as well. And, you know, I'm just very grateful for Munir. For the men that work with him, because he is very accurate. The police can't do it alone. Government can't do it alone. And I share his frustration when you see people that are only willing to point out problems and not willing to be a part of the solution. And to have someone so young have such a commitment to bringing that issue, to put that issue on the table when it's sometimes uncomfortable conversation. I'm just grateful that, you know, he's so committed to our city.
He's recruiting new members of the 300 Men March and doing trainings in the next couple of weeks and going into June. We'll be out on the streets all the time, he tells me. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Munir. Debbie in Baltimore, back to April 27th with a question about events of that day. Go right ahead, Debbie.
Yeah, hi. Hi, Dan, and hi, Mayor.
Hi, how are you?
Just fine. My question is, Mayor, what do you think the statement was made by our police officers when they were at Penn North standing? It was about 25 or 50 standing outside and on the streets. And what I got from that is they were there to protect property and not the people. And I am speaking from someone who is a former Baltimore City Community Police Officer. I know what it's like to get out of the car. And I was taken aback by the imagery and the optics that it appeared they were there for the property. And getting back to being committed to the community, we are opening up a youth center, Unified Efforts, okay, right there at Penn North.
Debbie, thank you. We'll try to go to that question that you asked then.
So first about the community center, thank you. Mm-hmm. I always applaud people who are willing to engage in activities to uplift our community. So thank you very much for that. And with respect to the optics and what I think it said, I can say that optics are never optimal in the midst of unrest. And to say what you think it looked like and what image, what we saw over the past 3 weeks is a lot of what you saw depends on the lens through which you looked. A lot of people said exactly that you know, they felt like the people were out there protecting property and not people. And then there were people who said the opposite thing. There were people who said that we only cared about the issues that were happening in the Black community, and we felt like we had abandoned many of the white parts of the city. Then there were people who were saying the opposite. You know, it just depends on that lens. And I can say that in the midst of all the unrest and the chaos that I shouldn't say chaos because it really wasn't, it, you know, it was very limited, but in the midst of the storm, I should say, you know, people looked through that lens with a very heightened sensitivity, and it was through that lens that people make those determinations. And it's not, you know, you can't really explain it. It's just what it is.
We have 2 minutes remaining, and I want to ask you about Governor Hogan. Mm-hmm. Governor Hogan played a big role in restoring order and peace in Baltimore City. So what happens now? Can you seize this moment with some urgency to get the state more involved in helping Baltimore through this and in the long term?
Yeah, I was encouraged that the governor was here on the ground. He got to hear firsthand from people what the needs are out of the community. He said very clearly that he heard that people in West Baltimore need jobs. We know that he has on his desk a transportation initiative that would provide thousands of jobs.
The Red Line.
Yes, the Red Line that would provide thousands of jobs. So I hope that he didn't just see and didn't just hear, but he listens and he acts. I know that he heard people talk about the fact that they need opportunity. Everyone knows the key to opportunity, the key way to make sure that you can unlock your potential is through education. So we're very hopeful that the governor will release that education funding. 11.4, I believe, is
for the
due
city,
to,
the city's part, and then more for the rest of the state.
Absolutely. You know, it was clear he has a commitment to supporting Baltimore.
Did you ask him about the Red Line when he was here or in the days after?
I think
since last week. I mean, since the curfew was lifted.
We have been, my administration has been in touch with his administration on the Red Line on school funding, and I'm looking forward to working with him.
Very good. Thank you very much for being here today, Mayor.
Thank you.
If you have additional questions for Mayor Stephanie Rawlings-Blake or those that you sent in by email and we didn't get to them, I apologize. We'll forward them to the mayor's office and get a response for you. Another hour ahead of midday after we take a break here for lunch and the news from NPR. So please stay with us.